We have been fortunate, comrades, in having Comrade Voropaev and his companion with us, the correspondent from TASS. He'll be leaving the area in a few minutes. We have been overjoyed by their visit. We give them our pledge of solidarity in the international struggle for Marxist-Leninist principles and for liberation of all peoples throughout the world. News of the morning. Apparently the New York Post is getting ready to try to bust its unions, as the Washington Post has already succeeded in doing. As an April 16th contract deadline approaches, the New York Afternoon Daily last week said that in the event of a strike, it would continue publication with scab labor. To prove its point, the management produced an experimental edition using supervisorial personnel and non-union workers imported from another newspaper in the Post chain. New York Post is owned by the right wing and certainly racist Rupert Murdoch, who has more and more made an appearance as a newspaper mongol in the U.S. scene. He was the principal inspiration of the first news attack upon People's Temple because of its socialist commitment, in conjunction, as you remember, with the Hearst newspaper chain. The Post contracts with four unions expire at the same time as those of two other New York City dailies, the New York Times and the Daily News. At the Times and the News, management is also adopting a union-busting posture. Although neither paper has imported scabs, in anticipation of a strike, some 10 unions, including the Newspaper Guild, mailers, and press operators, are negotiating with the three newspapers. The contracts are the first to be negotiated at the papers since the 1975 strike at the Washington Post, when the newspaper, considered one of the liberal bastions of printed news media in U.S., ousted the Militant Press Operators Union after a bitter year-long strike. The Washington Post, like the New York Post, under reactionary Australian owner Rupert Murdoch, trained scab personnel in anticipation of a strike. And when the press operators walked out, the Post replaced them permanently. Stand by. On Sunday last, the Guyana Peace Council sponsored a birthday commemoration of the great black American singer Paul Robeson, who, as you know, I had the pleasure of working with closely in the early 50s. Paul Robeson is known to the whole world for his great voice, which resounded through concert halls, worker camps, revolutionary meetings, and even on the battlefields during the Spanish Civil War. The function took place at Freedom House, where tributes were made and recordings of his voice were heard by all of those who remember his great contribution to the working class struggle. Bert Lance, President Jimmy Carter's buddy and link to the business world, has been, according to the Manchester Guardian, hanky-panking with the banks again. Or rather, he's been caught at it again.
Yes.
He never did stop, it turns out. Not even while he was budget director and the most powerful man in Carter's cabinet. Not even though he swore he would cut all personal business connections when he took office. It is the feeling of great segments of the European press that Mr. Carter will be in great difficulty because he continues to support his former cabinet aide,
yes,
advisor, Bert Lance, and Bert Lance still is carrying a diplomatic passport. Instead of stopping his activities, he branched out, according to The Guardian. The questionable banking deals and million-dollar personal borrowings that forced his resignation from the administration last September were expanded to recent months into an illegal intercontinental operation. Meanwhile, his friend, the president, thoughtfully expedited Lance in his intercontinental business travels by allowing him to hold on to his special diplomatic passport that had been his as a cabinet officer. On at least one trip this month, early part of the month, Lance even billed himself as special envoy of President Carter. This was too much, and the authorities evidently decided that they had to do something. As a result, Lance has been asked to turn in his special passport. More important than that slap on the wrist were the late March charges by the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, that Lance and nine associates, the SEC charged, were guilty of unlawful conspiracy secretly to acquire control of a $2.2 billion bank holding company, the Financial General Bank Shares Incorporated of Washington, D.C. Lance had expressed interest in a leadership role at this banking institution. In this venture, Bert Lance went abroad for backing, reaching out for oil money. His new partners included the head of the Saudi Arabian CIA and the head of the rapidly expanding New London Bank, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, the BCCI. Before Lance took office in Carter's administration, he was offered the chance to buy control of FG. He was already known to the owners and officers because it was from FG that he had bought control of the National Bank of Georgia. That deal did not go through. But in spring of 1977, according to The Guardian, when Lance was a member of the cabinet, he met at a Washington club with representatives of PG owners and management to discuss the FG again. By that time, of course, Lance had sworn to the Senate that he would cut all old business ties. Sometime later, Lance and a stockbroker friend from Little Rock, Arkansas, suggested the purchase of FG shares to a Pakistani banker who founded BCCI in London in 1972 by the name of Agha Hassan Abedi. Lance has worked for BCCI as an investment advisor. Abedi was involved in raising cash for hard-pressed Lance through the sale of part of Lance's holdings in the National Bank of Georgia at a profit to Lance. Without attempting to unravel all the intricacies, the SEC charged that the Lance Group had acquired 28% of FG without notifying the SEC. Stand by. the FG stockholders as required by law. The members of the conspiracy, according to the SEC, were the BCCI, Abedi, the banker from Pakistan, the Little Rock stockbroker, a Washington lawyer, FG stockholder, the president of FG, who happens to be an ex-secretary of the United States Navy, a Kuwait associate of Abedi, the banker from Pakistan, the Saudi Arabian intelligence man, and two members of the Abu Dhabi royal household, and Lance also, who had bought a small amount of stock in his wife LaBella's name. None of the accused, including Lance, denied the charges. Instead, on the day after the SEC announcement, they quietly agreed to a court settlement. This indeed happens when people are not too controversial in political lifestyle. However, Congressman Diggs, black congressman from Michigan, founder of the Black Caucus, and chairperson of the Congress Subcommittee on African Affairs, was not granted the opportunity to agree to a court settlement. He, as you know, faces 175 years in the penitentiary based on charges of fraudulent misuse of his own funds. Interestingly enough, no such charge has ever been levied at any white congressman while in office or chairing a committee or subcommittee. As you remember, the prominent and successful activist black woman leader in Pennsylvania, probably the next most prestigious black leader in the Black Caucus, Secretary of State of Pennsylvania, was also indicted and removed from office. We see a constant stream of harassment of racial minorities, as has been clearly brought to the attention of the public, though given little press attention, in a book that was compiled by Lieutenant Governor Dimely, who plans to visit our project in July, and sent his warm regards again late Sunday evening. Also, Lieutenant Governor Dimely did this book on the smear and the dilemma of persecutions of black and Indian politicians, along with the Lieutenant Governor Brown of Colorado. We also sent the warm regards of solidarity that we've had for years last evening from Angela Davis and Enola Maxwell, as we were corresponding over the amateur radio all night to attempt to show the humanitarian spirit of this socialist project. Many amateur operators come on with great inquisitiveness throughout the United States, seeking to know more about this cooperative project, and particularly its free medical care and its communal lifestyle. We are not allowed on amateur radio to get into the exact and precise discussion of our Marxist-Leninist views, our socialist consciousness, but the esprit de corps of the project is picked up readily, and people stand in line for the last 5 hours, in fact, till 6 o'clock this morning, just to CUSO, just to have a conversation with us here in Guyana. Many of those in the amateur frequency band are upper class professional people, and certainly none would represent anything less than the middle class, but they lead a life of boredom. The materialistic life in the United States, its emphasis upon property, putting property rights above human rights, the emptiness of its value system, leave these people, who are even a part of the establishment of U.S. society, bored and lonely. to such a degree that many will stand in line for weeks and have told us so, just waiting to have a conversation with us and to exchange an amateur card. Last evening was, of course, a very interesting evening to those that would be listening, because we received salutations from some of the greatest activists, socialists, and communist leaders in the United States. As you know, Enola Maxwell, Commissioner of Human Rights Representative, has been under rather severe attack herself, but representing a more modest support than we had, and so she only has a few dozen in her neighborhood housing association. She is not seen, by her own statements, to be a threat to the existing order. Angela Davis, of course, undergoes constant harassment, as she has been receiving, according to her own report, in her teaching experience, in one little post that she's been given in the Bay Area. Anyway, she sent her warmest regards to us, and we're very appreciative of our eternal bond of friendship with Angela Davis and others of the activist consciousness that we just mentioned to you. Stand by. U.S. farmland is reported to be the single most attractive item for foreign investors, according to a recent study by the European Investment Research Center, a private consulting firm based in Brussels. The consulting firm noted that Western European, Latin American, and Japanese capitalists invested over $1 billion in U.S. farm acreage in just the last part of last year. According to the Commerce Department of the USA, that figure accounts for one-third of all foreign direct investment in 1977. What we are witnessing, explained Agricultural Department economist Kenneth Krause, is the biggest continuing wave of investment in USA farmland since the turn of the century. Although farm values have slipped in recent months, analysts observe that foreign land speculators are attracted to U.S. farmland investment based on the long-term record of rising prices. Other factors include the falling dollar and the political instability of Europe and USA in general. According to Chicago's Northern Trust Company, U.S. farmland makes a good buy, especially for West European investors. The price tag on a prize acre of U.S. farmland runs to about half of the 3,000 value of that acre in France or West Germany. Landlord, allegedly protecting his property is the sacred cow of the United States society. In New York City, large tenement, slum tenement, landlord, owner, Paul Monaco, shot first after it was too late for questions. The threat to Monaco's extensive slum tenement properties was none other than 11-year-old Cyprian Septimo, 4'9", only 80 pounds. The Hispanic youth, possibly with a companion, innocently wandered into one of Monaco's vacant slum apartments. The landlord later told police that he surprised the youngster, the frail youngster of only 4'9" and 80 pounds. He surprised him in the empty apartment, yelled for him to halt, and getting no response as he ran away, pumped a .30-30 Winchester rifle bullet into the intruder. The bullet pierced little Septimo's left eye, exited through the back of his head, and knocked him off the window ledge to his death on the parking lot three stories below. Septimo never had a chance against the landlord. because he could not hear the calls to halt because he was a deaf mute. The youngster also had a chronic heart condition. The young victim's neighbor and family last week expressed outrage at the murder. "When you see this, do you shoot to kill in the head?" demanded former light heavyweight boxing champ Jose Torres after the incident. "Cyprian Septimo was playing with a 7-year-old son of mine." The Hispanic youth, considered underdeveloped, as many in the area of New York City are, often played in his immediate neighborhood with children only half his age because of his handicap. "What kind of trouble could he get in?" raged the dead boy's father, also named Cyprian, a Dominican Republic native. "He only played with 5- and 6-year-olds. Meanwhile, police...
Thank you.